of managing them separately. It was a mess. It was a hot mess. It was a... It got stashed in a small keg and put under the closet for some years, and it got better. They sometimes do. It's not a good plan to make something this bad and just wait long enough for it to turn good, but sometimes it happens, and it's not really, really what you'd call good now, but it's drinkable and kind of fun.
I think you're being a little modest. I thought it was very good. It was still. I definitely was getting mixed, like blackberry, raspberry. At least I think I was out of it.
You were.
And then we moved on to the, was it a 10-year-old traditional?
Is that really 10?
Yeah, I think it was a 10, 2007.
Yeah, oh man, that's some fine memories there. That was the last time everybody was together. All three kids and two parents were all together for a Christmas. And, you know, you can't really make meat as a group, but we all stirred it once. We all took a turn stirring the honey and the nutrients and the water together. And then it was kind of a sluggish fermentation, and it had a sharp note for years and years. Did you like it?
I thought it was very smooth. It's 10 years old. I was told it was about 16%-ish.
It might be. I would say it's more like 12. Well, it's more like 12. I don't know where they came up with 16. I called it standard, and standard doesn't go up to 16. The Hydromel is the low alcohol made. Standard is usually, 10 to 12 or 14.
So that was our very own Ryan at Homebrew Con, speaking to Linda from the Tippecanoe Homebrewers Club in Lafayette, Indiana. And she was talking about a mead project that had sat for 10 years, and it was a family affair. It sounds like even the little kids got a chance to stir, and so everyone in the family got a hand in it, which is a really cool thing. Anyway, welcome to the Mead House. My name is Jeff Schaus. We have a really exciting episode for you. Chris will be talking about some of the finer points in fermentation management and just some of the fine techniques that we go into that maybe you haven't thought of before. After that, I'll be talking a little bit about Brett. We came up with a little bit of a quandary last week, if you remember, because of the JD's Martian experiment. And then finally, JD's been wondering a little bit about extracts versus fruit and purees and things like that. So this should be a great show. I'm Jeff Schaus. With me tonight, JD Webb, Mississippi Chris Spencer, Ryan Richardson. Aaron is off tonight. Episodes you can find on our website, www.themeadhouse.com, as well as iTunes, Stitcher. Be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes, Podcast Addict, or your favorite podcast player. You can find us on the website, of course, www.themeadhouse.com, our Facebook page, The Mead House, or on our Twitter page, at The Mead House. Generally, we start the show by talking about going around the table, seeing what we're drinking. So, see, Ryan, what's in your glass tonight?
I am opening up a bottle of my Cole Spraggett, and we'll be drinking that tonight.
Excellent. JD, how about you?
I popped open a bottle of Graff, and Mississippi will appreciate this one. Gosh, I don't remember when we started this project. A long time ago. I haven't had a bottle for quite some time, and this is one of those, we had talked about it several times on the show, about how much this thing changes over time, as little as 1 week, and as much as several months, and it's still changing. A lot of the tartness has gone away. It's ice cold. I poured it in an iced mug. I shouldn't have done that. I should have let it come up to room temperature a little quicker, but maybe by the end of the show it'll get there. But I get the malty, apple-y flavor out of it. I think it's refining a little bit more. It's got a little bit of bitterness to it, and very drinkable. I'm enjoying this.
That sounds great. I'll go ahead and go next here. I'm drinking an Innocent Gun Original. It's a smooth Scottish ale, and this one has been oak barrel aged. I saw this at the liquor store here and thought that was really interesting, so I picked it up, and I'm damn pleased with this guy. A nice Scotch ale character to it. You know, you get a little bit of malty sweetness, a little bit of smokiness from the malt, and the oak aging really goes nicely with it. So yeah, I'm definitely enjoying this. Chris, what about you?
Well, I've got these three coffee experiments that Ryan sent us, and there's one out of the three that I really like, and it's probably the one that no one else likes. You guys know I'm a big, really dark roast coffee, really strong coffee fan. And there's one of these that's got some significant sour notes to it. I don't know what's causing it, but the dark roast coffee it has some sourness to it anyway, and I really like that. I got to say, though, the other two, earlier today, I poured them down the drain. And, you know, I was downtown on the sidewalk, and I was standing. I kept thinking I heard voices, and there was no one else around close, and it was coming from the storm drain, and it was the rats talking about this coffee mead that had come through earlier today.
Help me, help me.
Oh, no.
But, Ryan, I don't know which one this is, but you had one out of the three that, to me, was a real winner, and it's the one that's got the most sour notes to it.
Yeah, that one, if I'm not mistaken, is it was a dark roast, and what I did was I cold brewed just dark roast coffee. So I took a grain bag, and in that grain bag, I put medium coarse dark coffee and let it just kind of hang out in a sealed bucket of water for I think 48 hours or something, pulled that out and then added the honey and started fermenting from there. If I'm not mistaken, that is the one that ended up really sour. It went down pretty much completely dry, and it wasn't degassed very well, which is, I think, some of that carbonic acid that's in there is contributing to the acidity that you're picking up. Regarding the the rats thing, I don't blame them.
Yeah, the other two were pretty bad, but this one is, I actually like this one. This would be something that I wouldn't mind replicating because of the, it's almost got like a secondary fermentation quality to it, like you would get if you were trying to sour it or something.
I thought he stuffed his socks down the carboy of a couple of them.
Yeah, needless to say, making a coffee mead is not on my top list or anywhere near it. But from what I experimented with of, using the coffee before fermentation, and then trying some meads and talking to some mead makers, I think that what I would try next time is adding them in secondary and then being able to control, when I want to pull it out, just the way you would with any herb or oak or fruit or anything else that you're doing in secondary. And then after talking with Ash, I think there is something to be said for having a little bit of sweetness in there. I think that helps with the coffee. And then, like I said on that episode, but to balance that out for my palate, I would also oak it. So I think if I was going to do something else, I might do an off dry or a medium dry coffee and which I'd add coffee and oak to in secondary, and then see how that would work out. Now, sounds like I've got that all figured out in my head, but I've probably got about 25 batches ahead of that I'm more interested in trying.
Yeah, I failed on all accounts, and I made some good attempts, and I'm finished with it. If I want coffee, I'll drink coffee. And if I want mead, I'll drink mead, but not the two together.
Well,
that's
not
kind
willing,
of the conclusion I came.
I'm not willing to give up quite yet, guys. Since talking to Ash, I don't remember what. Let's see, was it episode 53? I think when we talked to Ash, I kind of like his idea of you know, we were all stuck. Well, those of us that did it, I think you know, especially Chris and I don't know what you guys used, Aaron. Ryan and Jeff, but I know Chris and I both use dark roast because those are the that's the type of coffee that he and I like to drink. I think Ash is onto something about using a light to medium roast.
I'm taking the Kenny Rogers approach to that. You got to know when to hold them and know when to fold them.
Well, you know what? And, you know, Ash was onto something about dropping a little bit into the fermenter under fermentation and then a little bit more, you know, into secondary. But, you know, bagging them up and pulling them, knowing when to do that tasting, you know, that's something that I didn't do and I probably should have. But I'm going to give it another shot, guys. I'm going to do it on a little smaller batch this time. But I'll give it a shot with a 1 gallon deal after I locate some light to medium, you know, roast coffee, good coffee.
Sounds good. Yeah. I don't know about, what Aaron chose for his, but I know I used a lighter roast. I generally prefer a dark roast like you guys, but when I was, searching around looking for sourcing a good coffee, I happened on this light roast that had a ton of body and depth to it that I really enjoyed. And it also had the roasty character that I usually find in that dark roast. So that's the one I used. And, you know, comparing the mead that Ash sent us versus, my own attempt, you know, it's not as good. And my own attempt, I wanted to be more like a dark roast coffee with some alcoholic punch to it. So initially I felt like I failed. But, you know, all things considered, it's, the one I came up with, I don't think is a bad batch at all. So as soon as I get a chance to send you guys another box, you guys will have a bottle of that to try too.
Yeah, and you know, and not spend all night on the coffee thing, but the flip side of that, and we need to get Patty Mackey on because she does a coffee, almost like a Kahlua-type mead. With coffee, and I really want to talk to her about that because that's something that I would be interested in as well. But
add some lactose or something.
She makes a very sweet mead, ages it on coffee beans and secondary, and what she comes up with is a very Kahlua-like a beverage. But I want her to get a little more specific with us and, you know, she'll let loose some of her secrets, and find out exactly what she does. So maybe we can get her on the show.
That'd be good. Now for, not to cut you off there, but yeah, we should get moving with the show. Our first segment tonight, Chris was going to take the lead on this and, take us through some of the finer points of fermentation here. So Chris, do you want to take that away?
Sure. And I want you guys to come in on this because I know you've got some ideas.
Sure.
All of us here on the show, we have done this long enough that certain things sort of become second nature to us. We don't think about mentioning it. And we've gone over and over all the basics of what we believe is good fermentation management. And each one of us, we've all got our own little nuances that we do differently. But basically, it all comes down to the same. You know, you rehydrate your yeast. It's a good idea to use GoFirm. We control our temperatures and all this. But there's these little fine details that we do with every batch, but somehow we just failed to mention them. And it's not because we were keeping a secret. It's just that, like I said, it's second nature. And I can sort of put myself in the shoes of a new mead maker and start to realize, okay, now I'm in the kitchen. I've got everything together. and I've listened to the Mead House, and I've written everything down, but all of a sudden these questions start to pop up. And I wanted to go over a few of those. And the first thing I was thinking about is things like fermentation temperature and pitching your yeast. And there is a difference between pitching temperature and fermentation temperature. And we need to hit on this. Now, I've always advocated fermenting at the lower end of what your yeast can tolerate. And generally, between 60 and 62 degrees Fahrenheit is about the right spot for most wine yeast. However, that's not where I pitch my yeast at. So if you pitched at 62 degrees, it's probably going to take off eventually, but you're probably going to have a, you know, 24 to 36 hour lag phase. So what I normally do when I'm mixing up a must, I put my honey containers in a container of warm water to loosen up the honey. And so by the time I get it all mixed up, my must is usually up in the 76 to 78 degree range. And so that does two things. It reduces the amount of steps that you have to take to get your rehydrated yeast to within 10 degrees, but it also gives them a little bit warmer environment to start in. So try to have your must a little bit warmer. That'll reduce your lag phase. You'll probably see activity no more than maybe 4 hours, and sometimes you could see it in, you know, under an hour. So what I do is I'll pitch the yeast in the mid to, you know, mid 70s, upper 70s. And then once I see activity and I know the yeast are going good, then I'll start dropping the temperature a couple of degrees an hour and just gradually work my way down to my fermentation temperature. It's just a little detail that for some reason nobody's ever mentioned it, and I think a new guy might wonder, should I bring this down to 62 degrees before I pitch the yeast, or what? So that's the answer to that one. Have you guys got anything in particular like that you do all the time but you have failed to mention?
I do. I do something similar to that. I mean, I have the benefit of having the twins. What I call the twins, the two stainless steel fermenters that have the immersion chiller in them. And like you mentioned, Chris, I mean, I'll pitch it in an upper 70s. You know, by the time, you know, you're rehydrating your yeast at, you know, from anywhere from 100 to, say, 104 degrees. I think most Lauvlin products are pretty universal that way. I don't pitch it that high of a temperature or even in the mid 80s. It takes a while for that yeast to come down to what I would call a decent pitch temperature, and that's going to be mid to upper 70s. 78 is probably the highest that I have ever gone. I think it's important to wait. And they say, you know, the 10 degree variance, I like to take it down, you know, within a couple of degrees. I just don't want to take the risk. And, you know, the cooling off, you know, once I get it into the fermenter, I have the luxury of firing up the chiller right away. So I can bring my must temperature from, you know, say 100 degrees down to, say, 78 or 6 degrees, you know, actually within minutes. And that's where I pitch. And then from then on out, like you say, it's every couple of hours, you know, after the lag phase and after my first feeding, I want to see the bubbles churning up in the airlock before I do anything. Once I see that and I know I'm past the lag phase and that first feeding, I start lowering the temperature every couple of degrees every hour.
Well, another thing I wanted to bring up is someone who started listening to our show and decided to start taking our advice, if you're switching over from another method and you're going to start following our recommendations here, you're going to notice some changes in your fermentation. And it's things that might scare someone. If you've been making mead for a year or two on your own, you're probably used to seeing the airlock just going crazy. And it's almost to the point where you can't even count between bubbles. And, you know, I've heard people talk about their mead dropping 24 points in 24 hours and even more. That's not what you want to have happen at all. In fact, we want to, the whole purpose of all this is to slow everything down. When you're dropping gravity that fast, you're making bad things, especially hot alcohol. So the whole purpose of this method is to get everything down low and slow and keeping the temperatures cool. And so when you switch over to these things, if you've made mead before, you might look at your airlock and you might look at your gravity drop in every 24 hours and you might think that, you know, my fermentation is sluggish. It's not sluggish. It's where it needs to be. It's not uncommon when you start, you know, dropping the temperature down in the low 60s and maybe you take away the DAP and you start feeding it Fermate O, you could see a bubble every 5 or 10 or even 15 seconds. Your fermentation is going to slow down drastically. There are some well-known mead makers out there who I have heard say just the opposite. You want to get that fermentation done as quickly as possible. I don't agree with that at all. The faster your fermentation, the more time you're adding to your aging requirements. If you can keep that thing low and slow, a good gravity point drop is about 10 gravity points, maybe 12 every 24 hours at the most. That's another thing I have failed to mention, that, you know, someone switching over to our methods, they may experience that and panic and start sending us emails saying, my fermentation is sluggish. What should I do? Do you guys know of anything else that you want to talk about? Because I've got a whole list here of things.
Ryan, Jeff,
anybody?
Speak up.
Anybody?
Yeah, I can throw in here. I know.
Well, geez, guys, sound effects.
Bueller.
I know from my experience, the fermentation feeling sluggish did feel wrong to me when I was first kind of getting into this going, okay, well, we're going to try this to up the game and make this a little bit better product. Yeah, there are definitely people that advocate, you know, a hot ferment, a fast ferment, hot in the sense of, you know, it's really active, it's really moving, not necessarily like a hot temperature, but we're trying to get that cooked through as fast as possible so you have something to drink as fast as possible. It definitely feels like this is counterintuitive, but the results do speak for themselves. I mean, you get that going in a nice, slow, even pace, so that it's not burning through its nutrients. It's not going to stall itself out or something like that. And the product is markedly better in the end result. You know, the sacrifice that you make in a little bit slower fermentation, generally I find, is more than made up for in the fact that I don't need to age it nearly as long to have a drinkable, enjoyable product. Generally, I can get a good product that I can turn to the bottle and serve to friends and family within 2 or 3 months. Whereas, you know, before when I was using the DAP and Fermate K and just kind of letting it go willy-nilly as fast as I wanted it to, you know, it was 6 to 8 months before I had something servable. So, to me, it makes sense, even if it is a little counterintuitive at first.
Yeah. So you guys don't panic when you see your fermentation is slower than normal. That's what you want. So let's just move on here. degassing. You know, JD has been, he's joked at me on the show, I think, several times about how I baby my yeast. And he says I probably sit and talk with them. And,
like pets. And,
yeah,
they're like pets.
There's a certain amount of intuition that goes into mead making once you get used to it. And when you've done batch after batch and you sort of notice all these little changes that take place and things that you did that caused the reaction, you build up this knowledge that you don't think about it. You just do it. And so I want to talk about stirring the mead and degassing for a moment. Normally, if you want a yeast to hit its tolerance and no more and no less, a good way to do that is to degas it twice a day for the first 7 days, 6 to 7 days, and don't stir it more than twice a day, morning and night. And you will generally hit your tolerance, assuming everything else is like it should be. But sometimes, for whatever reason, yeast may get a little bit stressed, and or they may just be a weak population, and you may need to coax it on a little bit. And so you can do that by degassing 2, 3, 4 times a day. And sometimes when you get down into those last, like day 7, day 8, day 9, normally you would be done with the stirring and degassing at that point. But if things aren't on track like they should be, sometimes just a little bit of extra stirring, and maybe even for an extra day or two, will help those yeast to get those extra few gravity points that you need to get where you want to be. Scientific evidence for that. It just, that's one of those intuition things. When you get down to that point, you should be well past halfway at that point. And you should be at a point where you can look at how fast the gravity is dropping, and you can say, okay, we're starting to get toward the end of fermentation here. These yeast they're trying to go to sleep on me, and I still got another 15 gravity points I need to drop. And, you know, it's that way of thinking that you have to sort of say, okay, I need to stir this a little more often. And another thing that we need to mention also is, in that same time frame, you might even have to raise the temperature a little bit. And this is a technique that beer brewers use, something akin to a diacetyl rest. But sometimes if you'll just kick that temperature up and maybe 6 or 8 degrees in the last, you know, like in the last 3 days of fermentation, you can eke out those last few gravity points that you need.
One of the things, you know, going back to the stirring thing too, the degassing thing, something that I fell upon, you know, when I started out, was the fact that stirring or degassing also helps keep that yeast in suspension where you want it. You want them swimming around and chewing on all that sugar that's floating around in there. To me, it's like, you know, if you're not degassing and stirring, it's like abusing your pets, right, Mississippi?
That's right. Yeah. you need to keep them moving. And also, another observation I've made is the meads that I have stirred consistently for 7 or 8 days and never missed a stir or a degas, they turn out to clear faster. And I've always chalked it up to the fact that the yeast themselves act as sort of a fining agent. By keeping that in suspension, when they do play out, they do go to sleep and settle to the bottom, they're going to take the other particulate with them to some degree. So I think that the leaves can act as a bit of a fining agent.
Yeah.
It just seems like they clear faster.
Let me throw this out here. As long as we're talking about degassing, what kind of methods is everyone using for degassing? Because I know for the longest time, I've been using one of those whip stirrers you use on Power Grill. It's really popular. It's really easy to do. Lately, I've switched over to using a vacuum pump to basically just pull all of the gas out of the solution. And it is even easier. There's much less contact for the possible pathogens as far as needing to sanitize things. I just basically get the end of the little thing that goes into the airlock hole. I set that on there and let it go. Do you think different methods make a difference here?
I use that method for degassing it after fermentation is complete. But I think during fermentation, I think there's something to be said for keeping that yeast stirred up in suspension.
Yeah, and there's something else that as long as you're stirring, your yeast degassing. There's another thing that takes place too if you're doing it correctly, is oxygenating or aerating your must, and especially in the early days, in the first 7 days. So you're accomplishing several things three things at one time. You're keeping your yeast in suspension. You're degassing the CO2 out of it. Plus, you're doing an amount to keep your. I mean, going back to the abusing. If you don't feed your yeast, they're gonna die. Okay, they need to breathe. For crying out loud, the dog needs to breathe.
Yep. Yeah, and I think keeping those yeast stirred up. If you allow the lees to settle too early in fermentation, they can form little pockets of undesirable things. So if there's any kind of bacteria or anything in there, mold or whatever, you don't want to allow that to ever take hold and start growing. And if you're not stirring it, if you're not physically stirring it, those things can collect in the lees on the bottom and start to grow and form a colony. Whereas if you're stirring it, they're constantly being exposed to the alcohol, and that alcohol level is constantly rising. So I think you're breaking those potential spoilage organisms up from forming a colony, and you're exposing them to alcohol. And you're keeping the yeast in suspension and probably making it more active. So I think there's a lot of benefit to physically stirring it.
Ryan?
Yeah, I use the wine whip on a power drill most of the time. And I've never had any issues. I think that works well. It's also what I use prior to pitching too, when I want to oxygenate it a bit or, get it really mixed up. So it's a good utility tool for me. They're cheap and, they get the job done.
I like the drill mounted stirrer myself.
That's what I use. And then once I, if I get it in the secondary, anything left over, I've got my little suction system, my little vacuum pump system, like Jeff does for the rest of it. There's very little left, but once in a while, like this, I've got a mixed berry, kind of a Braggot type thing going, experiment. It's a 3 gallon batch. Actually, it's a 4 gallon. I pulled off a gallon for another experiment, but and I used the Montrachet yeast in it, Montrachet or whatever you call it, from Red Star. Lots of gas in this thing, to the point where, every single day now, after I got it in the secondary, I've had to, stick the suction deal on top and suck the CO2 out of it. But anyway, yeah, so those are a couple of methods that I use.
And, speaking of, I got one other thing to add to this. Speaking of the yeast overshooting their tolerance or hitting the spot. I sort of was thinking about, I've heard several people say that they had had problems trying to get a yeast to dial in to where it was going to stop. And in fact, you had mentioned Patty Mackey earlier. I had exchanged emails with her a long time ago about, you know, she was having problems with 71B that was just overshooting way over its tolerance. You, on the other hand, have had the opposite problem. It's been stopping short for you.
Yep.
It's always been very, very reliable for me at 14%. I can almost tell you it's going to drop 104 gravity points almost every time for me, and it'll never be more than usually 2 gravity points one way or the other. So I started thinking, what can cause a yeast to either stall or overshoot? And there's a few things that I want to mention. Number one is, of course, the nutrients that you use. Fermate O, being a fully organic nitrogen source, is going to give you the slowest fermentation as far as all the nutrients are concerned. If you're feeding Fermade K, you're going to get a little bit faster. If you're adding DAP in with that Fermade K, that diammonium phosphate can really kick the yeast into high gear. And it's not uncommon. I mean, I've had it happen several times. If I put DAP in any amount, in any percentage, the alcohol tolerance of the yeast become totally unpredictable, and it's almost always going to overshoot. 14% yeast automatically becomes a 16-17% yeast. So that's one thing. The second thing is what we just talked about with the degassing and stirring. If you're degassing and stirring it more than twice a day, you can almost guarantee you're going to overshoot your tolerance, especially if you do it from day one onward. It's going to overshoot. The third thing is fermenting too warm, and I think that's probably the main culprit. Is when you get those temperatures up, anything above midway of the temperature range, that may be great for wine. It's not for mead. And I know there's some award-winning mead makers who are going to disagree with that. But I'm telling you what works for me. And if I let my temperatures get to 68 degrees, it's going to overshoot every time.
See, that's so where I ferment at 68 degrees. Mm-hmm. And maybe...
And you have sluggish...
Yeah, so maybe what I need to do is take the temperature down. Maybe I'll try a batch, just a simple traditional with some wildflower, 71B, and just take it down to 62 degrees or so. Mm-hmm. And there's kind of a and I may be it may be because I'm selfish when it comes to my system. The reason I keep it at 68. Is because I can go with both fermenters rolling at the same time. I can go almost 5 days without having to put ice in my big cooler. And mm-hmm. So it's kind of a no brainer for me. 68 degrees. That's where I need to be. If I take it lower, I'm going to be changing ice probably every 4 days with both of them running. Now I don't have mm-hmm. both of them running all the time, but, if I do one batch, I'll put a 5-gallon batch together with some wildflower 71B, and we'll just roll it down to 62 degrees and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me give you the number four thing that can cause this, and I'm going to make the prediction that the problem you've been having with a stuck fermentation is most likely due to this fourth thing here, and it's outside infection. depending on what organism you have present, it can either kick your yeast into high gear and send you, you know, 20 gravity points over where you were supposed to be, or it can stall your yeast. One that I know right offhand that will slow it down and stall it is a malolactic bacteria. There's a product called lysozyme that will kill off malolactic bacteria. And I do know that there are some winemakers who preventatively put the lysozyme in before they start fermentation and to purposefully kill it off. And then there's also some that are, they use it during fermentation if they need it. If their fermentation becomes really, really sluggish and it appears it's going to stick, they'll put the lysozyme in as the first measure. So a bacterial infection can really throw your yeast tolerance one way or the other. So if you're having trouble hitting your target gravity, you need to look at these four things, and there may be other things that I'm not thinking about also. JD, I'm going to say the reason you're having some stuck fermentations is because you've got some kind of infection in your equipment somewhere that's undetected.
Yeah, but that's...
And maybe you may have detected one of them.
yeah, it might have. But the strange thing about it is that's the only yeast I have trouble with. Now, granted, I do most everything that I do involves a beer yeast, and it's one of four. It's either SAFL 04, or it's Windsor or Nottingham from Danstar. Those are the only four yeasts that I use. Well, and I've done a B256 on occasion with beer too. With those, I have no problems whatsoever. If I do something with D47, no problems at all. With the
Montrachet.
Well,
I'm not sure about those beer yeast. I'm not sure about the beer yeast, but I do know that the 71B is a susceptible yeast. And it's susceptible to the kill factor that's put out by other yeast, like D47 has that kill factor. So, you know, those yeast with a kill factor, they may have some self-protection, whereas the 71B doesn't.
Well, you know, this may be where the point where I need to change my sanitizing liquids. I have been using Star Sand. So now maybe it's time. I think you recommended that, a number of shows ago, back in the beginning, probably somewhere around the first 10 shows, you recommended, you know, changing your sanitizing liquids, not every month, but 6, 7, 8 months, every year, maybe.
Every 6 months or every 10 batches or so.
Yeah, because it still bugs me that, you can still eat off the floor of my kitchen, you know. I mean, I'm pretty anal when it comes to sanitizing stuff, so I don't know what I'm doing wrong. If it's that, I don't know that. Like I said, you know, the only way to tell is to do another 71B batch and see what happens.
Yep. So that's all I've got on this. If I think of more things, I'll definitely bring it up. But there's, you know, it was just kind of bugging me that new mead makers might be standing there with questions. And I guess what we all need to do is we need to all step back and go make a batch of mead and just pretend we're beginners and think about all the questions that can come up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and JD, you mentioned having problems with 71B and no problems with D47. for my money, you know, I do find that beer yeasts are a little bit more reliable in that regard. But from my experience, I got started with D47, and I've picked that up a couple of times prior to that. I can get stalls on D47, but 71B seems to be a workhorse. The only question I get occasionally is whether or not it'll clear. And usually I find that if I try to repeat a batch that didn't clear, it's because I didn't put enough pectic enzyme in it for a Melomo or something along those lines. Just didn't give it enough time, something like that. 71B has been pretty reliable for me. So, you know, for those of you guys listening at home, your mileage may vary. And I think this goes back to what Chris was saying at the start. You know, you need to get some experience under your belt so you build that intuition. And you kind of know what to expect here from each of these. Everybody's process, everybody's results is going to be a little bit different.
Yeah. And I was listening to an episode, and I think it was Piotz that was talking about making meads. And he actually recommended that you pick out a yeast and use that one yeast, you know, for a period of time and get to know it. And maybe he's onto something there, you know. Mm-hmm. And then when you feel like you've taken sufficient notes and you know that yeast, go to another yeast, you know, and get to know that yeast so that you know what to expect. I mean, Chris has obviously done that. You know, he's been doing this for quite some time now. And, you know, like his 71B, he knows exactly, you know, he knows enough about it. He knows what's going to happen. You know, he's like a fortune teller.
Yeah, and I hate to be the one that gets in a rut with this kind of thing, but I've stuck with 71B because it does everything I want it to do. And to this point, I have not found a reason to not use it.
Yeah.
You know, I know it can be fun to experiment and do, you know, use different yeast and see what you come out with. But in the end, if you're wanting to produce a good product, you find what works and stick with it. And if you're having trouble, you know, deciding what yeast I'm going to use here or there, go with what you know. And 71B is one of those yeasts that has done everything I want it to do. I don't have a sensitive enough palate to be able to detect subtle differences in yeast character. I mean, it would have to be something fairly drastic, especially when you're working with some of the really heavy fruit flavors and things that I work with. Subtleties don't come through for me. So I'm, you know, it doesn't make sense for me to take a chance and use something I don't know, when I can just stick with what I do know and I know it's going to come out right. So your sense of adventure will dictate how much you try different things, I guess.
Well, and, you know, even if you're going the route to try different things, I think the advice to do a few batches and to get to know the yeast and what to expect is still valid. You may be going a little bit off the deep end. I mean, I have been playing with Saison yeast a little bit in the last year and a half, and really liking what I get out of it. I know I am not the first mead maker by any stretch of the imagination to do that. But you find what you like and you kind of improve on it. You get to know it. And just because you're experimenting with something once doesn't mean, you know, you get off the hook. If you like what the product was, you kind of owe it to yourself to become really familiar with that and kind of build that into your intuition toolkit so that you know what this is going to do too. Because you find something you like, you just want to repeat it. We're not working under any kind of a deadline here. We're not prioritized for anything other than what we ourselves define it. I mean, take your time, do as many batches as it takes to really get it down, and your meads will be better for it.
I want to hear more about the Brett. I know what prompted this discussion, damn it. But I do want to hear about it.
Well, and for those of you that may have missed the discussion last week, Mississippi and I were talking towards the end of our discussion about the can we just call it the funk growing in JD's fermenter there? It looks like some kind of a bacteria biofilm, and what it could be. And generally, it sounds like a lot of people are suspecting it's a Brettanomyces or Brett fermentation. We got a little bit of a disagreement as to whether Brett was a aerobic or anaerobic bacteria, and to give it a layman's terms, whether it works in an oxygen environment or an environment that is deprived of oxygen. By random happenstance, I've been reading the book Yeast, A Practical Guide to Beer Fermentation by Chris White and Jamil Zanishev, I think his host name is pronounced. And there happened to be a section about Brettanomyces that came up while I was reading it. So I kind of absorbed all that and wanted to drop a little bit of knowledge here as far as what's going on with Brett compared to our usual Saccharomyces strains that we're all used to here. So the Brettanomyces is still a yeast cell, and it is actually an aerobic bacterium. I'm not sure what the biofilm was about. That actually wasn't mentioned at all. But the interesting thing going on with Brett is that in the presence of oxygen, it will actually produce both ethanol and acetic acid, which is, it's the active ingredient in vinegar, and that's what gives Brett its interesting character, partially, because it's generally the sourness that you get from a lot of Brett what you would consider a major factor in its character. They've actually done a number of studies on beer with Brett and found that the ideal amount of oxygen in saturation for it is around four times the amount you would want at original pitch for an ale yeast. So it's actually really high. The weird thing about this, though, is that if you increase or decrease the oxygen from that point, it decreases the effectiveness of the Brett. Strangely enough, there is a saturation point where too much oxygen is just a bad thing too. Now that said, there are actually three strains of Brett that we kind of use frequently. One is the Bruxellensis, which is what you'll find in like Orvel and other Trappist beers from the Belgium area. The other is Lambicus, which, as the name would imply, is for lambics. You also see this used in Flanders Reds. The differences there, if you've had those, they're pretty striking. The Trappist ales have that very characteristic depth of flavor that they get from aging, and lambics tend to be much more acidic and have a lot more fruity character. It's a very fruity beer flavor. The third type of Brett is anomalous, and the thought is that this may be like an alternate strain of the Bruxellensis, the Trappist ale one, but it's a lot more subtle from what they can see, and they think that this is actually the one that was initially identified, because apparently when they first decided that this was a separate like variety of yeast from the Saccharomyces we're all used to, it was based on the secondary fermentations they were finding from cask ales and stouts in Britain, specifically like porters and stouts that had been undergoing a secondary fermentation in oak barrels. One of the interesting things about the Brettanomyces, though, is that it also has all kinds of other different like flavor components to it that, to some degree or another, also will add to the character of the beer. One of the ones that's always kind of derided by people that aren't a fan of the Brett is like a horse blanket or a barnyard kind of a flavor, wet hay funk. Kind of a...
It's just the funk of it. Funk.
Yeah, and there can also be a weird kind of a mousy character to it, too, from one of the side little flavor compounds that is thrown out from that beer. There are also a lot of really attractive volatile phenols to it that come out of it. And you get some interesting character points, kind of similar to a Saison, in that you'll get some peppery flavors. There's also often some cinnamon or other really sharp, unique, spicy flavors that will come out of this just as byproducts of that yeast fermentation. Now, generally speaking, in an oxygen-saturated environment, like I was talking about, that four times the amount for air, you can get a lot more acetic acid character being produced than the ethyl alcohol, or the ethanol, if you will. So there is a pretty wide range as to how long people leave the Brett to do its thing in the industry. In a lot of cases, it's as long as 5 months to get things going and get things where they want as far as the flavor. In some cases, when they're really on top of it, they're managing the oxygen, they can get that same kind of character in as little as 5 weeks. It's a pretty wide-ranging thing. Now, the reason that it's also derided in a lot of cases, there are two. One of them is that, like we mentioned last week, this guy can travel on air spores, so that basically any equipment is susceptible to it. Any open fermentations are susceptible to getting spores through the air that will kind of cross-contaminate and get Brettanomyces in there as well. The best advice for it, again, I think you mentioned this last week, have a separate set of soft goods, your vinyl tubing and things like that, that it's strictly for Brett, and have one that's your regular Saccharomyces stuff that will drastically reduce the amount of contamination possible, as long as you're using airlocks and things like that to keep the funk out. The other really derisive part about Brett that people dislike is that, in addition to the regular sugars that Saccharomyces is capable of digesting, it seems that Brett is able to actually digest a type of wood sugar, so that it can actually be very damaging to barrels once it gets introduced to those. If they have a colony in a barrel, it's actually able to digest part of the cellulobiose, is I believe the term for it, one of the sugars that make up the wood structure. And it gets in there and it will thrive even if there's nothing in the barrel other than the Brett contamination in like a water storage base, essentially.
Funny you should mention it. I think that was one of the, I don't know, was it the first or second things that Mississippi asked me about the stout thing that I got going. He asked me if I put any wood in it. And I had to go consult my notes because I couldn't remember. And sure enough, I did. And so, Mississippi, I think you and I kind of believe it might have come from that.
That's where I put my bet. I would say it came from the oak.
I mean, Jeff talking about, wood barrels and whatnot. I don't want to toot my own horn, but seriously, okay, on a serious note, you can literally eat off the floor where I do all of my mixing, okay, because I sanitize the crap out of everything. And so I cannot believe that it was unsanitary conditions that had led to this. I got to go along with Chris on this.
Yeah, and, it's entirely possible.
I want to ask Jeff, I want to see if I'm understanding this correctly about the oxygen. Would it be correct to say that you could sort of manipulate the character that you get from Brett by manipulating the amount of oxygen exposure?
That is within a certain range of like optimal oxygen level, then yeah, that's what they're saying. The other thing that I forgot to mention is that there's another way to manipulate that flavor, and it's actually the starting gravity at which point the Brett is being introduced. They found really the optimal amount of flavor you're getting from it is 1055. In cases where it's a little bit lower, the flavor that you get from it kind of comes up as weak and insipid. There's just not enough for it to really work with, I guess. And then the above about 1060, they're saying that it gets an almost vinous quality. And I think that has more to do with the acetic acid that's being produced than anything else. For a mead, that's probably less of an issue, I would say, than a beer, per se. But yeah, there are different ways to manipulate the character that you're getting from Brett. And really, this book only touched on the surface a little bit. There's probably a lot more research that's been done in the field, especially, you know, people that are looking into the Trappist beer industry, for one, other, you know, sour beer fermentations. I know last year, especially, it seemed like everyone was creating a Brett beer or a sour beer or some kind of kettle soured beer. So there may be a lot more information out there, but this is just information that, you know, for my own personal reading, I happened on. I thought it was useful since it came up last week.
I'd be interested in knowing. I want to look a little bit more into this whole oxygen thing, because it's still confusing to me, because the bread itself forms a pellicle, and the purpose of the pellicle is to keep out oxygen. And it's but yet it's an aerobic bacteria. So,
right.
That's confusing to me. So I'm going to have to dig into that and see what I can find.
Now, that I need to correct you there. It's actually Brettanomyces is a fungus like yeast. It's not a bacteria. It's within the same family. They're essentially cousins of each other. Now bacteria do generally form a pellicle, and that is generally to keep oxygen out and essentially seal it off. For Brett fermentations like that, I wonder if it's more of a kind of a competition factor, where that pellicle, once it's formed from airborne spores and bacteria and crap like that, keeps out other airborne shit. Pardon my language. Just basically forming a lid on top of it so that nothing else can settle on. And it's a competition kind of a thing that they've evolved to do, more or less as a protective measure. That's,
you know, I don't know, but I will tell you something else I came across, and this may be unreliable, I don't know, but I did come across a thing where a guy had asked, how do I know when my Brett fermentation is finished? And the consensus was, watch the pellicle. And when the pellicle drops, you're done.
Mm-hmm.
So that throws another twist. And is it a competitive factor, or is it actually part of the Brett? I don't know.
Right.
This is a whole thing that I have almost no knowledge about at all, because it's not something I've ever played around with. I think it's something that bears looking into, because there's a lot of character that you can put in no matter what style of mead you're making. And, you know, we need to school ourselves on this. So,
oh, sure.
Hasn't Ryan done, I thought I've heard Ryan mention he's done some bread, or accidentally or on purpose or something.
Yeah, I've done a couple of breads, and they have been on purpose. I've done one that is a beer, a straight beer. I've done one that was a straight mead, a traditional, and I used Brett. And I also had used, it was a yeast pack that had some different, there was Brett, and I think there was also, hell, now I'm going to forget. Let me check here now that I'm on the spot. It had Brett and lactic acid bacteria in there as well. So that, and then the other one was a Braggot. So I had a
a mead, a beer, and a braggot that we're all doing that. And those are all going for a while. We're designed to sit for a while. I had a Brett beer at a brewery, local brewery here, that was 7 years old. And it was really good. And the brewer had said that, you know, that Brett, and some of the other, I don't know if there's anything else in it as well. Like, I guess it's some kind of other bacterias or things like that, that just keep developing and keep, intensifying over time in a really positive way, you know, not like finding a stale IPA or something, but continue to evolve and intensify. And it was really good. So I put these aside and I thought that these were going to sit for about 2 years before I did anything with them. I wasn't even going to really test them for 2 years. And it's, you know, about a year in, and I'm staying strong. I haven't, other than making sure the airlocks are topped up, you know, I haven't stuck a wine thief down there or anything to take a little sample. So I don't have much to report on those.
But now, you, Ryan, you also had something else happen unintentionally when you steeped that chocolate malt, was it, that time? And...
That was the honey malt, a Canadian, you know, honey roasted malt or honey malt, whatever they call that. And right, that, I don't know if that was Brett. It probably was Brett, but it, you know, I took the grain, you know, right out of the big, you know, grain bins at the homebrew shop, and I cold steeped it, you know, in water. And then after it had cold steeped, you know, I added the honey and fermented it. That's before I added the honey and fermented it. I have to go back and check if it was before or after, but there definitely was something else going on. It developed the pellicle and it had that kind of distinct barnyard smell, but in a very, very pleasant way, like the way that, you know, some of those are supposed to smell like that. It was probably Brett. I don't know. It could have been something else. But that one was unintentional. And that one is also just kind of sitting, hanging, doing its thing. I haven't tried that one either. I should say I did try it when I racked it. When I racked it, it was good. I mean, there was no flavor profile that would say, hey, this is bad for me. This tastes off. It tastes wrong. It had a good, a good kind of sourish. And I don't mean tart when I say sour. A lot of people, you know, put those two things together, but it had a good sour kind of flavor, and I was going to also continue letting that one develop.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'll bet when it comes to mead, I'll bet there's nobody around that's probably put as much into souring a mead as Frank Golbeck. You remember the conversation, JD, that you had with Frank from Gold Coast. And he went into a little bit about how much trouble they had had trying to get a mead to sour.
Right.
And they had even gone so far as to try and acclimate different strains to be mead specific. So, you know, he might be a resource we need to talk to about how this pertains to mead. I mean, I'm sure that just about any intermediate level beer brewer out there is probably laughing at us right now because beer brewers tend to, you know, this is something that's kind of the going thing right now. And they probably have a lot more knowledge of it than we do, but you're in a different world when you start talking about mead. And you know, you already know that with yeast, you know it with fermentation temperature, you know it with nutrient additions. And I think it's probably going to hold true for things like Brett and all these, you know, making these lambics and things like that. Maybe Frank needs to come on the show and tell us what he's, because I'm sure he's made some strides even past where he was by now.
Yeah. Ryan's in charge of our calendar. Let's get him on the calendar. I'm trying to get Jeff back. He's up in Canada again, and he just dropped out. So I'm trying to get him back.
I'm back.
Hey, there he is. All right. So let's put Ryan on to Frank Goldbeck at Gold Coast, and because I'd like to explore this a little further. Something that I've been doing a lot of reading in the Homebrew Talk forums, and something that I'm noticing, and not places too, that sours are really becoming popular. I even see them on the shelf at the Total Wine and the BevMo here when I go shopping. So there's something up with that here lately. And I know we've talked to us, you know, some meaderies, and I think it's starting to appear in you know, these in several meaderies as well. So,
you know, and you know, Ricky the mead maker brought up a point. He said, if you make a hydromel and you don't have like outstanding honey, you end up with something that doesn't have a lot of character on its own. And that was his reasoning behind this really hot fermentation, to try to get character from the yeast. This whole souring process is just another way to add some character to something that by itself may be very thin and lifeless. So I think it's worth looking into.
Yeah. Cool.
Ryan, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to go a little more philosophical and say that, you know, what's old is new again. And what I mean by that is, you know, everything is cyclical. You know, it was in the 60s music became popular again, and then 80s fashion became popular again and things like that. Well, if you go back to early American brewing or even European brewing, every single beer they had was soured, you know, because they didn't have the same sanitization methods and airlocking and things like that. And if you go to any of those historical, you know, reenactment, you know, communities, and they talk about the beer brewing they made, if they've got a decent brewer who's there, you know, walking you through it, every single beer that they had up until, you know, I don't know when, into the 1900s, early 1900s probably, was a soured beer that had, you know, Brettanomyces or Lactobacillus or Pediococcus or something else in it.
I'd say even into the 1930s and 40s, because, you know, it was during that time too. This is, you know, I think it was the 1920s when the whole milk thing happened, and a lot of this was due to, you know, I mean, they did. I don't want to give anybody the idea that, you know, they didn't care, but things were not as sanitary as they are today, type of thing. And that's what happened to the whole milk thing. That's why you can't buy raw milk in many, many states. They've outlawed it, but that's a whole other. That's a different show. That's that milk.
And I wonder, Ryan, how long it'll be before that way of thinking comes around with me, because I'll give you a little interesting thing I came across. I'm sure all of you have heard of that really old book. I think it was from the 1600s, 1700s. It was the Closet of Sir Kenelm Digby,
something,
you know,
yeah,
the mead maker. I downloaded a copy of that, And I'm going to go back and look, and I'm going to find it and send it to you guys, and because it may be a way of interpreting the wrong thing. But I was reading in that, and I came across a paragraph that followed a recipe. And in that paragraph, he was describing this mead that he had made. And he said that if you follow these directions, you can come out with a mead that is completely void of any honey character. And when I read it, the way it was worded, he was, you know, giving this mead such high praise. And I said, you know what? These people back then, they didn't want you to know that this was made from honey. Because the best of the best recipes in this book, he always refers to, it's such a great mead because it lacks any evidence of honey or anything like that. Now, today, we do everything we can to make sure we get plenty of honey character. It's right there in the BJCP guidelines, you know, that it's just not mead if you can't taste the honey. So I think maybe they had a whole different idea of what they were after.
I wonder if there were some undesirable qualities that were coming out that they were just calling, you know, oh, this is honey, you know, or for, I guess a better way to say it might be, I wonder if there were undesirable flavored meads that had more distinct honey flavor in them, and that it was seen as a positive thing to not have those. And I'll give you an analogy. What is the highest compliment that someone can give a fish dinner? Well, it doesn't taste fishy. Yeah.
It doesn't taste fishy.
Yeah. I mean, so I wonder if it's that kind of a situation, right? Where it's that type of a thing where the highest compliment you could give a mead back then was to say, it doesn't taste like honey. Kind of like the highest compliment you can give a fish dinner here is, it doesn't taste fishy.
Must be something wrong with my fish then.
Yeah, that's why I want to send a copy of this and let you guys read it and tell me what you interpret from it. But that's what I got. I got the idea that they did not want to get a honey character. But if you read the recipes, everything in there is boiled and brought up to a boiling for, you know, sometimes an hour or two. So it's likely you weren't going to get any honey character anyway.
He said boiled, not bold. So those of you out there going to listen to this, yeah, boiled.
Boiled.
One thing I'll throw out here, you know, they're not looking for honey character. They're not saying the same thing about floral character either. And if they're boiling it that much, they're probably not getting any floral character out of it at that point anyway. So I'm kind of with Ryan here. Maybe this is just a case where the market at the time was so.
So what? I think we lost him again.
We lost him again.
Yeah, just skipping every other word there. I have no idea. Hey, Jeff, stop talking.
I think we're getting an echo lag or something.
Hey, Jeff, if you can hear us, stop talking for a minute. Let it catch up with you. It's a long ways from here to Canada.
You might have some editing to do.
Yeah, well, it's going to be hard to get those noises out, but we'll let Jeff settle down here a little bit. I'll push things along here. You know, I want to come back and revisit this whole Brett thing because it's an interesting, I hate to call it a category, but it's an interesting approach. Like I say, I tend to find that, you know, sours seem to be
a ton of honey.
Jeff's still talking. let it slow down there, Jeff, for a minute. But anyway, we'll come back and visit the whole Brett and sour thing, because that's another area of exploration that we certainly need to do. I want to step back a couple episodes, maybe 8 or 10, and talk about flavoring again. I've come across some interesting aspects of this whole thing. And, I like making my beer. I like my braggots. I'm slowly starting to get back into making traditional type, just honey and, water type meads, fruit and whatnot. Something that I've noticed between the beer making home brewer and the mead making home brewer is what they use to flavor their meads with when it comes to fruit. And it seems like there's a majority, not a big majority, but there is a majority of people out there that actually use extract for flavoring their beers. And I got this sound clip, but Ryan was at the Home Brew Con and he talked to Steve Wilkes about using an extract. So let's run that piece.
Before I get to the tasting notes for everybody, you said you're using extracts. Have you compared or tried using, fresh ginger as opposed to a ginger extract?
Well, I've been brewing beer and making mead and wine for well over 20 years. So I've made lots and lots of ginger beers using fresh ginger. Mm-hmm. I've made ginger meads using fresh ginger. Now that I own a homebrew store and I sell ginger extract, I decided to see if it was any good or not. And I've decided that it is pretty good. That, in other words, the convenience of it and the predictability of it is a positive for me. So that doesn't mean that I won't use fresh ginger in this case again. That brings a different component to it, a different flavor to it altogether. But this works, and it did what I wanted it to do. It kind of punched the flavor up. It kind of it helped it, I think. Oh, and then I forgot this too. So at bottling, I added 4 ounces of a fresh pomegranate syrup that I picked up at our local organic co-op.
And that was Ryan talking to Steve Wilkes from Brain Freeze.
From Steve's Brew Shop and a regular on Basic Brewing Radio.
Basic Brewing Radio, yes. And he was talking about using an extract for one of his meads. And I believe it was ginger. Now, he still prefers to use, the real deal. And I think most people do. But I'm wondering, with fruit meads, I mean, is it possible to accomplish the same thing with using extract versus real fruit? And here's how it tends to work out here. With fresh fruit, you get the least amount of flavor per pound. Okay, so it's going to take a lot of fruit to get to a point where, you're more than likely going to be satisfied with it. Puree is more concentrated and the flavors are a little more accessible. The problem with puree, like real fruit, it's going to leave a pretty sizable mess at the bottom of the fermenter. Extract, on the other hand, is probably the most concentrated, uses far less, and probably the most effective. The problem with it is, I think you got to be careful with using extracts, because imitation extracts that are available out there in every brew shop are going to taste like imitation. So you really, I think, have to search out things that are naturally made, natural extracts without any artificial flavorings. I'm wondering, and here's the thing about using extracts in a mead. You have to put it up front. You can put it in the back. You can put it in just before you bottle. and you know, like they do, you know, in beer. There's no sugar in extract. Any bit of sugar that might be there is, you know, really going to be, you know, inconsequential to your batch. And then, of course, there's the juice, which is probably, you know, the best. And, you know, the one thing that juice gives you is no stuff at the bottom. You're not get that pile of crap at the bottom of your carboy or your fermenter. The reason why I bring this up is because I turn around, I'm looking at my cocktail-inspired concoction in this 7-gallon carboy, wide-mouth carboy that I ordered specifically for this project. You ought to see the amount of coconut that's in this thing. I mean, there's 2 pounds, and when it's in a bag, it doesn't look like a lot, but when it gets wet and you put it in a fermenter and a carboy, there's about 5 inches of coconut floating on top of this carboy, besides the 4 pounds of pineapple and mango that's in there with it. So when the time comes, I'm going to wind up with a hell of a pile of crap at the bottom of my fermenter, which is probably going to, you know, turn that 5-gallon batch into about a 3-gallon, maybe 4-gallon if I'm lucky. So I intend to lose a lot of liquid, you know, when it comes down to it. My only other recourse is to run it all through a filter, and I'm not set up for that yet. But I kind of wanted to run around the table and get you guys briefly, because I know we're running out of time. But let's just run it around from Ryan to Jeff to Chris and find out, what do you guys think about using extracts in a mead? What's your take on that whole thing?
I've never used a fruit extract. I've used tinctures from herbs and spices and even oak that I've made myself. And those seem to be okay. If, you know, the eyedropper and the graduated cylinder, or whatever you need to do to kind of figure out your proportions. But with fruit, I've always either added juice or the whole fruit. And I've found that to work pretty well. I do have, I got a bag here and a sample of, it's a bag of, I guess, I don't know if it's puree or extract or what it is. Actually, I've got both. I've got a puree and an extract of fruit that I am going to play with. I don't know what I'm going to do with them yet. But it is a little more foreign to me. So it will be an experiment. But you know, I think there's now I'm gonna upset our PETA friends. But there's a lot of ways to skin a cat, and I don't know if there's a right way or a wrong way when it comes to using fruit. Just kind of what you're going after.
Jeff, what's your thought?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, I'm not really a big Melomel guy as much as some of the other guys here. My methaglin game is pretty strong. I'm slowly but surely improving my Melomels. For the most part, I have been using whole fruit occasionally. I've used as an adjunct to other stuff some of the fruit juice from a health food store. I forget the brand name off the top of my head.
Knudsen?
I like the idea. Knudsen, yes. That's it. So I like the idea of using an extract, especially something along the lines of a tincture, which I can make for myself. I previously had some bad luck with tinctures, but I actually created a sweetgrass every time I.
Bye, Jeff.
And that's always not allowed to talk. I tell you.
Go ahead, try it again.
I stayed up my left foot. Yeah, I like the idea of using an extract, especially something I make myself. I've had a tincture made of sweetgrass that I'm waiting to have a mead to put into because, oh my gosh, just two or three drops in like a little liter-sized carafe of water. And my wife and I have a new favorite like drink just to have when company comes over. It's really amazing stuff. So I'm looking for the right mead to put it in, kind of wondering how I'm going to do that as far as dry, sweet, things like that. Doing the same kind of a thing with fruit is a really attractive option for me because, like you said, that's easy to dial in at any time. Just a few drops even before you bottle, and you've got so much control over it. So it's definitely something I want to play with, I think. I was just going to say the method for it, I want to play around with a little bit too, as far as, you know, how you extract from the fruit, whether you mash up the fruit like I do with a lot of the melons I've tried, whether you're using dried, fresh, a little bit overripe. But it's a promising idea, I think.
Yeah. And I want to, you know, I'll kind of reiterate here. It's not that extract is a big thing in beer, but it's quite popular. And it's a tight race when it comes to using real fruit or extract. But, Chris, what's your take on the whole deal of using extract in a mead?
Well, I've only done it once, and it's been very recently. Unfortunately, I can't disclose what it was because I intend to win one of those damn Mazer Cups, and this is going to the Mazer Cup.
Awesome.
And I mean, I'm going to win. I'm prepared to meet with the Russians if I have to win a Mazer Cup. I mean, I'm going to do whatever I have to do.
without revealing what it is, are you satisfied with the use of an extract? Because this, you know, I think there's, you know, when it comes down to it, there's a school of thought out there, oh my God, fresh fruit is the only thing you should use in a mead. But on the other hand, you know, you've used juice. Now, the other thing I didn't mention about juice, you take a bottle of, let's take Chris's Heart of Heart Murmur thing, you know, using the fruit juice. I mean, one quart of cherry juice, tart cherry juice, is like 12 pounds of cherries. So, mm-hmm. You know, when you compare fruit, you know, when you start thinking about pounds per gallon, you know, we always like to say 3 to 4 pounds a gallon seems to be the average. Imagine putting 12 pounds a gallon in a car.
Well,
it's just not going to work.
Actually, I have found that you get about, like, let's see, 4, maybe 5 cups of juice for every 3 pounds of fruit, generally, with most berries and things like that. But that's not the discussion here. As far as extracts, I say if you've got the fresh fruit or the puree or a good quality juice, I say stick with that as far as you can. But in situations where you need to kick up the flavor because of inferior ingredients, if it saves a batch, I'm not opposed to it. And one example I can think of is something like trying to make a cider or a sizer or a graph here in the United States. We just don't have access as your general home brewer, we don't have access to good cider apples here in the United States. We don't have access even to good cider apple juice. So it's not uncommon to try to make something like that and you come up short on apple flavor. I wouldn't be opposed to putting a good quality natural apple extract in there to bump up the apple flavor. In a situation like that. Now, what I did was not a fruit extract. It was just a flavor. But I will say this. I have found that after doing quite a bit of research, the best ones and the most natural extracts that I have found have been by a company called Olive Nation. And they have a large variety of different extracts, and they're all direct extracts from the actual food or whatever it is you're trying to replicate. So you might want to look into that. But yeah, I'm not opposed to it. I just don't see it as a first option.
Yeah. Well,
I would use the extract as a corrective measure, I guess.
Well, it's one of those experimental things because, you search out there for recipes, and every recipe out there for a fruit, for a melomel, is X amount of pounds of fruit, and, up front or in secondary or both. And nobody talks about it. A few of them you find out there, they're using juice. But I have yet to find anybody out there talking about using an extract in a mead. Especially after reading lots of stuff about, the amount of homebrewers brewing beer that use extracts in their beer. So I thought, well, let's throw it out to the table here. I want to leave you with this. If you haven't yet, I kind of discovered on accident because I was listening to an episode of, I don't remember if it was on Beersmith or one of the other ones, but they were talking about the BJCP, and there's a section there that you really got to check out. I find it very useful. The BJCP Special Ingredient Descriptions. It's a PDF. You can download it. And it's got a significant amount of information in there about kinds of honeys and fruits. And it gives kind of a brief description of each one. And I mean, I just flipped a page. Elderberry, huckleberry, key limes, passion fruit, peach, mulberry, pineapple plum, pomegranate. Even getting into spices, teas, cardamom, chai tea, well worth the download, I think, if you're really looking to experiment with your mead. So that's bjcp.org, Special Ingredient Description. BJCP Special Ingredient Description. It's right there in the menu. You can't miss it. And we'll throw a link up to it on our website. So that's all I got. I want to throw it back to Jeff to close. And Jeff, don't forget to mention the Facebook page, The Mead House, and our Twitter, at The Mead House, and then our website, of course, is themeadhouse.com. So don't forget those three things.
Oh, of course not. So as JD just said, if you guys have questions, please reach out to us. We thrive on our audience participation and listeners. We love to hear what you guys are working on. You can find us at Facebook. The Mead House, at The Mead House on Twitter, or just www.themeadhouse.com. There's plenty of ways for you guys to get in contact with us, so please do reach out to us with your questions, your comments, anything you're working on. We love to hear from you. It's the audience connection that really makes this show what it is.
And go ahead, close it out.
Well, I was just going to say, that's a pretty good show for tonight. So we've got the end of our content here.
What's our next show? Who's sweet? Don't we have a guest on our next show? Susan Root.
Yes, right. Susan Root of I'm thinking the name. Prairie Rose. Thank you.
Prairie
Is going to be on, and we'll be speaking with her. And let me see. I don't think we have the other topics worked out just yet, but right, we'll be back next week, and we'll see you then.
Cool. All right, guys. Good night.